I listen to the Black Guy Who Tips podcast because Rod and Karen are hot.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Black Guy Who Tips podcast with your host Rod and
Karen.
And we're live on a Monday afternoon.
Yes.
A great quarantine Monday out here, guys. Just out here practicing social distancing and having a pretty socially distant guest right now. Okay, guys?
Yes.
He's coming through you through the internet. If you guys are live in the crowdcast, you're seeing him. If you're listening later on the podcast, you're hearing him. It's the one and only Mike Kaplan, who you guys should know from his stand-up album Vegan Mind Meld. He's been a guest on our show several times. He's has his own podcast, Broccoli and Ice Cream, Hang Out With Me. He's had so many podcasts. He's been a frequent guest on Keith and the Girl, one of our favorite shows. It's Mike Kaplan, stand-up comedian. What's going on, man?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I can confirm, in a different place than you. It's not like you just turn the camera that's on you and look at me. We're in, I don't even know what building or city or state you're in. I probably could have done some research, but I am very happy to be quote unquote here. For the people watching, it's like only like probably a split second delay from right now. And if you're in the future, hello. I hope it's better. Yeah. I mean, no matter what. Even if it's great right now, there's many things that are great. There's many things that are other things as well. But right now, I am certainly grateful to be talking to you, communing with humans who are caring, nice people. So thanks so much for having me and saying nice things.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Aww, thank you.
And I figured the way the show is going to go is we'll probably just mostly talk to Mike and do like interview type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mike, we'll ask probably like 4 to 5 questions. A couple hours later, we'll be done, you know, and we'll wrap it up. Mike, but you right now you have an album coming out called AKA, All Killing Aside. Can you tell people about May the 8th?
You
know, guys, you don't have to leave the house to like risk coronavirus to get it. You can go online and get the album. You know, hopefully saving yourself and all your loved ones. And you can also give it electrically, you know. You can go to blondemedicine.com/aka to get it. Mike, what's the new album about?
Thank you so much for setting me up perfectly. It's true. I am not traveling to do comedy these days. I'm doing a lot of shows online. I'm also available for a pickup and delivery. So if you come to my home and stand 6 feet away, I will deliver. You can pick up my delivery, I guess is what I'm saying. So the album is called AKA. I've been working on it for several years. I recorded it last year. I brought it to Edinburgh to the Fringe Fest the year before that. It was called All Killing Aside at the time. We decided in these times of uncertainty, disease, death, sadness, that having out of context, if you see the name, maybe the word killing might jump out and it might not be your fate. Maybe you're like, I want to escape from that. And I'm like, no, All Killing Aside. Or maybe it'll sound like a tone deaf thing. Be like, yeah, I know a lot of people are suffering, but All Killing Aside, let's have some fun, Mrs. Lincoln. You know, what else did you think of the play? That kind of thing. And, so it was, but in context, the album, the hour of comedy is like, something that I care about. It is about essentially not murdering. It's about, how I would rather be, if I had to participate in a murder, I would rather participate as the victim. I would rather be murdered than murder. I don't mean to say that I'm a hero or doing anything controversial here, but, so the album, you know, it's about kindless love and not murdering. And so calling it All Killing Aside made sense to us, but then I talked with my album's producer and my mom. My mom was like, ooh, killing. I don't think that should be in the title. How about All Kidding Aside? And I was like, I like where you're thinking. I like that. That has at least a single entendre to it. We're calling it AKA, which stands for All Killing Aside. Also for my mom, it stands for All Kidding Aside. And also it stands for Also Known As. So it's an alias for the album that was once the, it's like Prince, like the artist. I'm the artist formerly known as, Michael Kaplan spelled normally. And the album is the album formerly known as All Killing Aside, AKA AKA. And so I think that's basically the end of this Ask Me Anything. Again, my name is Michael Adam Kaplan. The album's called AKA. So this has been my AKA MAKAMA, my Akamakamas. So I thank you for asking. It does come out on May 8th, which does also have the MA in it. It's my girlfriend's birthday. So if you want to do my girlfriend a birthday present of getting her, getting yourself my album, I think that triangulates, and it can be pre-ordered right now. Whenever you're listening to this, it can either be pre-ordered or it can be ordered. It's either order or pre-order, which is chaos. This is kind of chaos, but it can be, you can be on your way to ordering. If you pre-order it now via iTunes or Apple Music, you'll get the first track immediately, and then each week until the album comes out, you'll get another track, and then on May 8th, you'll get all 17 tracks. Oh, one more thing. AKA is, of course, a palindrome, the same backwards and forwards, and the album itself, the Hour of Comedy, is also sort of a conceptual palindrome, where there's like parentheses at the end and the beginning, and then as you move through the album, it's sort of Inception themed, and the very middle track, the very middle joke of it is about the movie Inception and how that is what the album is like. So if you have followed this, enjoyed this, me talking about this, the album has been called Hilarious and Layered, which I have put together and called Hilarious. I have layered the layer inside Hilarious. So if any of this has been the kind of thing that you like, you will probably enjoy the album. And if it is not, then the album is actually much different. It's full of jokes that are totally different from what I'm saying now. So I think there's no way to not like this album that is available for pre-order now and comes out May 8th. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, man. Vegan Mind Mill was genius.
Yes.
And then
thank you.
Yeah, and then also like it's so weird because like it's been a while since we had Mike on, and it's all on me. I have forgot to get back to him one time about having him on the show. And I don't know if this happens to other people or not, but I got in my head so bad where I was like, yeah, man, so I blew that. Now it's embarrassing to even approach like, hey, man, you should come on the show, because it's like I totally fucked up that one time. And then like time just kept going, and it's like the further it got from the time, the worse the embarrassment was in my head, not in real life. Like it wasn't actually happening, but it was happening to me in my head. Just randomly, I don't know, we were interacting on Twitter, and Mike DM'd me like, yeah, I could come back on the show maybe and promote that. I was like, oh, fucking of course. Like I thought, you know, in my brain, it was like, I've ruined this, quasi relationship thing. So, you know, thank you for coming back on the show, and I'm sorry that it took so long to get you back.
It's all the more sweet. I have a few things. I really do feel like, your estimate that you would get to ask 4 or 5 questions might even be a little on the high side, because I do have a lot to say to what you just said. Number one, thank you. Number two, I've never been mad at you. That was all in your head. I always see you on Twitter. I see your tweets. I like them. And I do understand it as well. Like years ago, probably 2010 is like when I put out Vegan Mind Meld. So 10 years ago now.
Wow.
And that's also, I was listening to like Mark Maron's podcast, and like we'd done some shows together, and like he was sort of like the angry comedy dad that I felt like I'd never had, because my dad doesn't do comedy and is nice. And I think Mark has done a lot of growth as well, and it's a lot of like we're good. That's my impression of him saying that we're good. And I remember one time I was on a show with him, and we were like in the green room, and he got up, and his girlfriend at the time was sitting next to me, and I like kind of whispered to her, like as a joke, but also for real. I was like, what does Mark really think of me? And then she said legitimately, she's like, he only talks about himself. So I want to say, he also has a wonderful joke about doing a show once, and there's like everyone's laughing in the audience except for one guy up front who's like making a face that Mark has. He's just like focusing on. He's like, I can't believe this guy hates me. This guy's just like, fuck you, man. Just like, I can't. And then after the show, that guy comes up to him and is like, hey, man, that was great. He's like, oh, that guy was just, the fuck you guy was just in my head. And so, of course, that's just the point is a common experience that we can all have. We all, like, if somebody's email or text slips away, we're like, oh no. And then the more it goes, the more we think we're like, oh no, but if I write now, then it'll be the worst. But tomorrow, it's even worse. But tomorrow,
yeah. So
I guess this person who I care about, I guess we can just never talk again because right. I let it go one day too far. And the concept of embarrassment itself, like, I think it does take two for there to be embarrassment. Like, if it's only on one side, you can feel embarrassed, but like, unless I am trying to make, unless somebody else is like, look, you're look, isn't it embarrassing? Cause if it's only inside, I mean, maybe that's shame. It's something. There's right. something, a feeling happening, but it's not like, you know, certainly I never would have wanted you to feel that way. I hope that you can retroactively undo it. Like, there's a quote from the book The Prophet by Khalil Gibran that I love, which is, the greater that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Mm. And so whatever sorrow was experienced, was carved into you, maybe that's like a tall word for what we're talking about here, but whatever that you experience, now it can be like replenished, filled with hopefully the joy of knowing that you never had to feel that way, but also don't feel bad for yes feeling that, don't additionally beat yourself up for having beat yourself up, a thing that I think I also have had to learn about, that you can get into these spirals. I don't know if you know me, but I can sometimes spiral upward, inward, downward, but the point is, like, I have gladly known who you are and been engaged, and I didn't – if I had known that we were involved in a one-sided, your-sided-only feud this whole time, I would have reached out sooner. From my end, I mean, I wasn't thinking, like, oh, I guess he didn't get back to me because he doesn't like me. I – sometimes maybe that is what's happening, and right. so it's, like, nice to have a sense that, you know, that anything is possible. Like, oh, maybe something else – usually it's just something else is going on with a person. Right. They get busy. They have things happening in their life and mind, even if, like, as a comedian – sometimes I'm on stage and a person will leave the room, and sometimes that might mean that they don't like the show and they're leaving forever. Sometimes it might mean that they're going to the bathroom. And so for me, like, there's no need, I think, unless somebody's like yelling at you and right. they're maybe it could go either way. Like, I'm going to the bathroom. Just want to, you know, I don't want to show, but I'm going to go to this again. Or if somebody's like running out and being like, I'm leaving because I am unhappy. I definitely went to the bathroom before the show and that's not what this is. Like, well, maybe you're actually, is that, I'm protesting too much. So I just always, especially if nobody says anything, I just assume they're going to the bathroom. Even if they never come back, I'm like, they just had to go for a long time. They really needed something. Who knows what's going on inside a person emotionally or intestinally? You know, who yeah. knows what they need, what they are experiencing? So whenever anybody walks out of one of my shows, I'm always like, they just have to go to the bathroom. Even now, if my confidence is so strong, even if they are saying something like, I am leaving because I'm unhappy, I'll be like, probably they're unhappy because of the bathroom situation. Like, whatever it is, it's not my comedy. It's not me. It serves me, like, to both be, like, it's how I got into comedy. If I didn't have the delusional self-confidence to think that I had something worth saying, then I wouldn't have gotten on stage in front of audience that were like, this is not worth saying. And be like, well, you don't know what you're talking about because I have extra delusional confidence that was given to me by my loving family. So good news, I'm here to fake it till I make it eventually. So the point is, thank you for having me back on the show.
Oh, well, I'm glad you came back. I'm glad we could do this.
Me too. It's yeah. always a joy.
Glad to know it was in my head and all that stuff, man. I actually have a couple more people I have to reach out to because it's just the same thing. And like, it's time to break the cycles in 2020, okay?
Yeah, and everybody is sitting down now. So since right. everybody is sitting down now, you can actually catch them.
No excuses, okay? The COVID is out here. There's no reason to be outside. So we're just doing it. How have you been getting by in, you know, like since the lockdown? Cause you're in New York, right? And like y'all have been for a while.
Yeah, I think, interestingly, I think we were, my girlfriend and I, who I live with, we were on a cruise when the pandemic struck, when were like removed from society in a place that, like, you know, if the cruise had been scheduled for like even a week later, it probably wouldn't have happened. Mm. But we went out, like, it was sort of, you know, it was happening in Italy, it was happening in other places, but we're like, okay, they're taking precautions. Like on the cruise, there was all these, like all the staff was trained with, there was like Purell, there was hand sanitizer everywhere. Like, you know, people were, you know, elbows instead of shaking hands, or like, you know, waves, or, you know, namaste type things. This is a half namaste that looks like I'm gonna punch somebody because I'm holding a microphone. But we were thankfully got off, so we went on the boat on March 7th, got off of it March 14th, and then got home thankfully, like, as far as we know, like, healthily, safely, comfortably got home. And then it was like short, right around then that people were like, stay there. Just, you got home, now be in your home. And like shows started being canceled, tours started being canceled, you know. And so my life, I was like, oh, I was going to go to Edinburgh for the Fringe Fest. Oh, okay, they're going to, okay, they canceled the whole thing. Great. Okay, so that's not, it's kind of nice that there's, I mean, you know, in within the context of the uncertainty and so many people being sick and needing treatment and not knowing whether you're going to get it and dying, like within that, like there are these at least moments of like these moments of connection and the moment of like, well, the solidarity that we're all experiencing this, that across the country and the world, that so many people, like it's not like there's FOMO, like we're missing out on something that's happening. Like nobody's missing out because we're all experiencing the only thing that's happening, right, which is staying at home. I was about to, I'm like, what if I combine the words FOMO and home? And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say foam. Yeah. No FOMO. And, so no fear of missing out. Like I always strive for myself to think like that if you fear missing out, then the thing that you miss out on is not having fear. So my goal is to not have fear. And in these times, it's maybe challenging to do that all of the time, especially with the unknown, but for at least for my own, like for my career, for my, like, which is a lot of things are just on hold. Like touring is on hold. My release shows in other towns, not on the internet. Like I'm doing things on the internet now, streaming, like things are adapting and filling the place where I would have been leaving my house to go do things. But it's kind of, I assume, like, how is it in New York? It's very similar inside my apartment to inside your apartment, I bet. You know, it's like, that's what New York is like. Like, I'll leave the home, you know, to go to the grocery store, the co-op, or to, you know, to take a walk far away from other people in the park near my home once in a while. But mostly, you know, for the, I think my girlfriend has only left the home twice, like once to go outside to just wave to a friend who had gotten us groceries, and then one, and to, you know, you put it down and then put it on the fence and then right. back away and then I'll take it, like everything's a drug deal now.
Yeah, it's like in the movies where people do like that, you know, they have that moment of like a kidnapping or a hostage
exchange.
It's always like, it's like, all right, same time, man. Same. Okay, you back up. All right, now I'm gonna back up. Like it is very intense now. We got food yes. delivery, and like the guy delivers it, and then like walks around the corner and kind of like, because the way our apartment is set up, it's like our apartment is on one side. There's another apartment in front of us, and there's the hallway, right? And so they go to the hallway and just kind of like, this is multiple guys now, stick their head around the hallway, just kind of like,
you're like, you good?
Make sure that we got it. We're just, it's like, got it, buddy. Everything's fine. But yeah, it's become very intense. But I do like that. You know, I'm glad your cruise was already conscientious of it. You know, right. Like, the sounds like the cruise crew made it a cruise. Yeah. They made it a cruise. And then I think now that we're home, and you know, you're home with your girlfriend, I'm home with my wife. I feel like now everybody's more of a home, more sexual, you know, because we're all in the house. Karen, what were you gonna say?
That's great. A home more sexual.
I mean, we can only beautiful. Hope, right? You can only hope that it's a home more sexual. Yeah, you could be home less sexual, or
yeah,
you know.
And I'm a hope more sexual. And I just added to your thing. You started it. If anyone's mad, it's you. If anyone's happy, it's me and you. But yeah, being in the home, I mean, it's funny, like, my girlfriend loves read, she's reading a lot, she's knitting a knot, she's knitting a knot and then undoing the knot, and then I am not knitting, and so I don't even know how to say knitting a lot, but, a knit knot, that's what I am, and a knit wit, she's a wit at knit, but I'm a wit at knot. So, this is what I'm doing, basically, is getting on the electronic systems with people, doing podcasts, doing streaming shows, doing my own shows, and, you know, Instagram live, Zoom meetings. I thought today, this new idea, you know, they say when you assume, make an ass out of you and me, but I say when I do a Zoom, I make an ass out of ooh and Okay, so, here I am. But it's, in some ways, obviously my life at home is different in that I don't leave my life at home very much, but each day individually, like, you know, I wake up and I sometimes read something from, like, I'm reading a book by Ram Dass now, or I read books by Pema Chodron or other Buddhist teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, read a few pages of that, and I then meditate for usually 20 minutes, sometimes with an app. Right now I'm doing this Oprah and Deepak Chopra, which they don't call the Oprah Chopra thing. I think they should call it the Deepak Winfrey thing if they're going to go in that direction. But they have this program for like 21 days, a different meditation each day. And then I do some free writing, like this, either a letter to my girlfriend or my mom or to a friend or just for myself, or journal writing. And so these are like, before I look at the internet, at the news, at social media, I just start with, you know, myself, a kind of centering thing. For some people, it's prayer. For me, it's meditation. And I read this thing once by a guy named Alan Cohen. He has like a lesson a day book. And one of the lessons was that, think about how the formative years of a child's life, of a human's life, is like, they're so important, you know, to get the nutrition and to get the care and the love and the shelter and clothing and physical touch and, you know, emotional well-being, everything. If you don't have all of that, you might not be as nutritionally like healthy as you need in, right, you know, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual ways. And so the formative years of the life are important. And this guy, Alan Cohen, says the formative minutes of each day are like that too. If you start the day by frantically, you know, scrolling through an infinite web of disaster, then that'll start your day on one foot. But if you start the day, you know, as peacefully as you can, at least for the first, you know, few minutes, 5 minutes, 10, 20, 30, whatever you can do, if you have the opportunity to do that, if you don't have to get up and zoom out to a job, if you can, if you're in your home and you don't have to do something immediately, it's such a valuable thing to be able to start, have the formative minutes of the day, set the tone for the day, be like, oh, just like, you know, take a breath like I haven't done in the past 20 minutes since we started talking.
Karen, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, do you think that drug deals are done more openly now? Because, you know, like you said, it's like a drug deal. Do you know, like, real drug dealers are like, hey, did you get my package? All right, I'm going to head around the corner now.
It's kind of weird, though, because, like, also the cops simultaneously have, like, more to be afraid of like, regular people, right? Because we could just, like, cough on them. But then they also have, like, more, they have, like, less to do. So I wonder, like, is crime, like, way worse? Like if you did a crime now, they just, like, the police just sitting there in the corner waiting already, like, yeah, it's about crime 30. I can't believe I have to do this. There's nothing else. Or are they just like, you know what? Let them deal drugs. I mean, they don't have masks. I'm okay. I don't know what they're doing out there. Mm-mm.
It's better than having them walk outside with no pants on. So kudos.
It's true. I did read, I mean, it's sort of a double-edged sword that, with more people in their homes, like, I read that ISIS even was like, we need to be concerned about the coronavirus, and that murders are down. The murder rate is down, though, unfortunately, because so many people are at home together, if you live with a domestic partner, domestic violence is up. So it's, I mean, not a thing like, the good things don't make the bad things better.
Right.
They just all kind of exist simultaneously, that there are some, like, there's a comedian, Tony Deo, who has this hilarious joke. I love him. Tony's very funny. He went on Conan and he talked about whatever the maybe Hurricane Andrew, hurricane something that hit New York, some years ago. And he said, I forget what the numbers are, but it said, he looked at the news said the hurricane has killed this many people in New York today, maybe like it killed 80 people in New York today. He's like, oh no, that is tragic. And then he's like, but I'm going to look up how many people normally die every day in New York from just the various natural causes and accidents. And it was a higher number. It was like 120. So he's like, this hurricane saves lives.
Save 40 lives. Right.
Like, by the numbers. So you the numbers, of course, don't say anything. And like, so even if, like, I don't know what the numbers are, like, for, you know, every day in New York compared to Corona, but obviously there are marginalized communities. There are, you know, suppressed and compromised people. There are the elderly. And, you know, my girlfriend has asthma and she is concerned that, you know, anytime she gets sick, it affects her lungs. And so there's certainly, there's different people suffering in different ways all the time. And it's good that we're doing all that we can, everyone who can, to help protect not only themselves, but also, you know, the people who have to keep going out, the heroes at grocery stores and hospitals and all of that. And like you said, I hope, I would imagine that the police are less active because of less people out, less, you know, less crime, less people, like even criminals, quote unquote, you know, people who would be like punching each other, you know, for whatever reason. Like, it's funny to see, like, in movies now, like, watching movies in this time that were filmed, of course, like, even more, just more than a month ago, I'm watching and I'm like, don't touch each other. What are you doing? Stay away. Why? Don't even punch him. Just do something else. Like it's so, how much we've adapted. So I assume that there's fewer, that, like, there's just there's, everything has kind of, thankfully, it necessarily slowed down.
Yeah.
And so glad that, I mean, unfortunately, you know, there still are the people who are in prison are still in prison, and the guidelines of like bail and sentencing are, you know, there's less, and they're less letting, accountability.
They're letting some people out, and
they should.
Like in Charlotte, in our city, they let some people out. Charlotte, North Carolina, that's where we're at.
Gotcha.
So they let some people out here, but, you know, obviously not necessarily enough. And then there's also like this thing too where like I saw the police a video of police on like it was a subway, I want to say Philly or New York, and I think it was Philly, because there was like a rule like you have to have a mask, and this guy didn't have a mask, and there were like 13 police dragging him off the subway and be like, you gotta get a mask on. And I was thinking to myself, like, what if police handed out masks?
You know, that I saw that literal, somebody posted, maybe it's in England or some other country. It was like, here, you get harassed by the police for not having a mask. There, the police are handing out masks to people who don't have masks. It seems like the simplest thing, it's like an analogy, like when I was a kid, and you'd be like talking in class, you'd be like whispering, and the teacher would kind of yell at you sometimes and be like, hey, if you want it to be quiet, why don't you not yell? You know what I mean? Like, you're not modeling the behavior. If you, hey, don't threaten people, don't yell at people, don't harm people who don't have masks, when the goal is, the mask is to help. The mask is to help people be safe and healthy and protect everyone. So like more than ever, the idea that like punishing crime, like the goal of like rehabilitation is a lofty one. The goal of like helping people, you know, like not hurt themselves and not hurt each other. That's what we're trying. That has to be the goal. Right. The other thing I just thought, which is much less important than what we're talking about, but I am imagining like a lot of heist movies coming out of this, and it's just like everybody has masks, and they're like, the people call the police show up in a mask, everyone in the bank has a mask, they're like, what do they look like? They look like they have masks. It could be you, it could be me, we're all suspects.
No one even has, no one even has a gun, they just walk out, it's like.
And you're making me think, Mike, how about they come in and they actually clean before they rob? We don't know if this person has coronavirus.
Right.
Put all the money in the bag, but first put all of the hand sanitizer on the money and put the hand sanitizer on the bag.
Did you bring the Kleenexes?
Now drop the bag and move 6 feet away. I'm going to pick up the bag. All right. It's kind of interesting too, because like to pass the time, I've been like watching a lot of stuff. I watched on Netflix this series called How to Fix a Drug Scandal. It was about the people who work in the labs that test drugs for the police to okay. So like, you know, you get arrested with suspicion of drugs, right? They mm-hmm. put you in jail. Well, they send your drug, they send the stuff they confiscated from you somewhere to be tested right. in order for them to know that it was actually drugs, right? Because
yes,
it could just be soap and or whatever. And so what was happening was we covered this on the show, but this is for 1 hour episodes of a documentary, which made it much more like in depth than we okay. could possibly do, right?
Okay.
And we just kind of covered like the big steps, right? We're like, wow, this woman got caught doing drugs while also testing the drugs. That seems like that's not a good thing, and that could have been thousands of people's lives that were affected by that, right? And then there was another woman, and I had gotten them confused, but there's two different women. There's another woman who just straight up was like doing four times as many drug tests as everyone else because she was just cheating the system. She would so like she would take like one thing, test it, and then apply the, like, you're supposed to test, like, say there's a, I don't know, there's like a small baggie of drugs, right? You test that, and then you test it against like 6-7 other different agents and all this different stuff just to verify that it's correct. She just find like one positive, and it just boom for the like then fill the whole sheet out and just be like, all of it's positive, right?
Oh.
Right. And so it was interesting how they went into depth with that, because like the one woman, she was like, she got addicted to drugs. Okay, her name was Sonya. Sonya got addicted to drugs, and then she would do the drugs she was testing, and then file the report or whatever, and then like by the time they would even like catch up to some of the stuff, drugs are missing, drugs are misfiled, she's taking drugs and like pouring water into drugs to cover her tracks, like crazy, crazy stuff. And then
she could have been such a hero, you know, just doing all the drugs and then saying, nope, no drugs here.
Yeah. what drugs? Like, they just come in. She's got, like, cocaine in her nose.
There were drugs?
What? There were no drugs. I didn't get any drugs this morning, if that's what you mean. Anyway, I'm going to go outside and do jumping jacks. But she got, like, so it was interesting, right? Because the other woman was, like, I can't remember her name, Annie something, but she was just like straight up, everyone was like, what she did was wrong. Like, she was basically forging drug tests and clearly sending people to jail that may not have even had drugs. And she also was very chummy with the prosecutors and stuff. There were emails back and forth. She was married at one point. She created a fake email account and forwarded it to a guy she was interested in and pretended like she wasn't married. So she just had like some serious, severe issues. But this other woman, what I found interesting is the crux of their story was there was a lot of sympathy for her because she became an addict. She was addicted to drugs. Yes. And she was doing all the drugs. Like,
all of them.
The drugs came in, she was giving it a shot. You know what I mean? Like, at one point she said she did like LSD. And so she was tripping while also doing the drug test stuff. So she was like, and her thing was like,
wow.
Yeah, in her mind, she was like, listen, I know all the work I did was above board. Even if I did the drugs, I mean, it must mean there were drugs, right? Because I did the drugs. They worked.
I did the drugs.
Right. But then
maybe she did the LSD and then she hallucinated that there were drugs everywhere else.
Right. I was like, but like at first I was kind of like, yeah, I guess that makes a weird kind of sense. But then when she said she did LSD, I was like, that doesn't make as much sense as you think, because what if you did have a trip and you're just like, everyone's doing drugs, or you were just sitting there like, no one's doing drugs.
She seen all the colors.
Yeah. She said at one point she was doing crack and she would like, she didn't know how to do crack. It's like every time she would just try drugs. So she had to like make her own crack pipe, which she didn't really know how to do. And then she never had smoked drugs. So then she like went and started figuring out a way to smoke drugs using aluminum foil. And she would go to the bathroom to smoke the drugs. And then they have another room that like pulls fumes up so that people can't smell it. So she'd go in there and smoke the drugs. And all this stuff. She like dropped some on a bathroom one time, and she was like, she was tripping because she was doing like LSD and crack, and she didn't know if she really dropped it and it was like someone's gonna walk in the bathroom and see crack, or if she like made that up and there was no crack on the ground. So she was like searching and couldn't find it, and she was like, I don't know what's real. But all this stuff to say, She was doing drugs from like 2004 to when she got found out in about like 2013, I think, something
good
like that.
God.
Yeah, maybe 2015. I think that's when we were talking about on the show. And so they like kind of covered it up. They said, oh, she was only doing drugs for like 6 months, but because she was an addict, she was going to like different like addiction associations, and she kept a journal, and the journal went back to 2004. So like when she had the job, she was on drugs. They don't do drug testing, all this stuff. Right. Now, all that to say, the argument was, well, everyone she convicted should stay in jail because they're a criminal. And she should not have to go to jail much, or her work shouldn't be that impugned by too much because she's an addict. And it's funny how the designation of criminal and addict for the same crime, essentially, right? Because, you drove a car on drugs, you should go to jail. You tested drugs on drugs. The results of what you're doing should be called into question the same way we would call into question a driver driving a car on drugs. But the disconnect was so like huge, and it was so weird because like this legal system that wanted to keep these quote unquote criminals in jail also wanted to keep her above question, right? They wanted to be like, no, her work is fine. We don't need to look into it. Nothing's wrong with what she did. We don't want to vacate any of these cases, okay? That work is fine. Nothing's wrong with that. And then also, guys, she's an addict, okay? She needs help. She needs our sympathy. These people need jail. They need prison, and they don't need to come out.
But they don't need our sympathy, right?
Yeah, and that's when Mike brought up the whole thing about social distancing in jail and letting people out of jail. It's funny how people go, criminal. You're in jail, criminal. No sympathy, but most of the people in jail are in there for drug offenses, nonviolent crimes, not being able to pay warrants and fines and things of this nature. That should not be a reason to let someone get coronavirus.
And also shouldn't be a reason even without coronavirus that people should be held, you know, if they can't afford even like, you know, the minimal, like bail. The whole bail process, I started volunteering with a group in New York called Court Watch NYC, and we go when possible. In the before times, we would go into the courtrooms during arraignments and watch as DAs, like, it was just the beginning of cases, and we would like just take down the demographics of like of the accused of and basically what the crimes were accused, what they were accused of, and what the bail requests were, because like bail laws changed at the beginning of this year in New York. Mm-hmm. So we're making sure, like, it's to hold them accountable for, like, because DAs, like, there's no record of, if nobody's there watching, like, they don't just write down and release, like, these were the cases and this is what we offered and this is what the defense said and this is what the judge said. So we just take notes on all of that, and then it's compiled and then used to hopefully help, you know, spread the word and make it so that there is more accountability in the system. And like, I learned more about like the history of bail itself. I mean, like, it's to make sure, like, you're innocent till proven guilty, and bail is before you've even had your case. Like, it's to make sure you come back to court for your case when you're innocent, before potentially being proven whatever you are. You're an innocent person. So there's so many people innocent in jail because they can't afford the bail. Right. And most people, I think the statistics show, most people don't run. Most people come back to their court case.
Right.
Most people show up. So like, that's why the bail laws have changed, and it's good that they are continuing to change a lot of places to be like, okay, do you promise to come back or else we put you in jail for more? Like, most people are going to come back. Most people aren't just running away from most crimes because some of them are like, they took a soda from the store or, you know, they like pushed somebody when they were drunk or whatever it is. Like, so many of the things aren't like, you know, murders. Like, most crimes are less of a big deal. Like, and certainly for drug offenses, like when you're the only victim of your own crime, like, those things shouldn't be crimes, like, at all. Yeah, like, it's literally victimless. And we see, especially in this case, like 2004 to 2013, this person was on drugs the whole time, didn't die. Like, most drugs don't kill you. They can certainly, you know, cause your life some great hassles. But some of that is also like the legal things. Like, if you can't seek treatment because you, if you would want to seek treatment because otherwise you'll be criminalized. Like, everybody here, like, deserves to be, if you want to not be addicted to drugs, everyone deserves sympathy because it's potentially a disease. And the fact that they're saying, you know, of course, the point that you made, that they're giving, like, she deserves sympathy. Other people don't just like, no, oh, you were almost there. If she deserves sympathy for doing this thing, then these other people who did that thing, I mean, like, you know, white supremacist patriarchy does everything that it can to just make everything. Okay. But we're just going to like stretching and contorting to be like, well, okay, the system can't be the problem.
Right. Like, and this, like, in addition to her being like, because the one woman who was like, I mean, both women were quote unquote criminally negligent, but the one woman who seemed to be more like, I don't give a fuck about these people. I'm like, prosecutors are literally emailing her and being like, hey, can you rush the drug test on these people? These are some really bad guys. We want them off the streets. And you're not supposed to be able to do that. And then if a defense attorney, would email her and be like, hey, my guy is doing such and such, and this drug test result, we want to like, call it into question, so can you da 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 da, she would then email the prosecutors and be like, can I respond to this or should I just ignore it, you know, stuff like that, that shows that she's not like a unbiased part of the system, she's a biased part of the system. So like, she was like kind of patently really messed up. But then this other woman was kind of just like, she's an addict. She's a white woman. The other woman's brown, like Indian. So she's an addict. She's a white lady. She's, her tests are a little bit more like quote unquote reliable because she is testing drugs, but then she's using the drugs. But still, even with all that, the thing I really love was that the defense attorneys for these people who were, they were like, we need these incarcerations vacated. Many of the people, keep in mind, were out of prison by the time she's been doing this for 10 years. So many of the people they served their time. They were out of jail, but they had this on their record.
Right.
So now, you know, having a record in America basically means you're not hireable in many ways. You can't, you can't live certain places, things of this nature. So they wanted was this vacated. But I appreciated the defense attorneys because they did have this sympathy for her that didn't feel like, because she's a white lady, it's like, no, we have this sympathy for our clients because they've done crimes, quote unquote, but you know, sometimes it's because they're on drugs, it's because they're addicted to stuff. They like, if many of them are fighting to get clean, you're not gonna find that in jail. And that's why we're fighting so hard. And so their sympathy for her, I understood. Like, I appreciated their ability to see her humanity and see everyone's humanity. But then the systems, like the prosecutors, the GA, the AD or whatever, those people, DA, they were like, no, she's human, not the rest of these people. And that was the conflict that bothered me.
Oh yeah, I mean, that makes complete sense. It's funny that the DA, like, they, when you think about a court case, how they call it, they say it's the people versus the DA represents, quote unquote, the people.
Right.
But they are the one, I mean, like, who are the, we're all the people. And if anything, like, I'm on the side of the innocent people.
Right.
It's like the system versus the government.
Which people?
It's all of us. And here's another quick thing. Like, I haven't watched the series or the documentary that you're talking about, but, and so maybe this is addressed, but I work, I volunteer, or I'm a member of this Park Slope food co-op in my neighborhood in Brooklyn. And sometimes one of the jobs that's necessary to do, like everybody who shops there, works there, does something like once a month, is when a cashier gets done with their shift, there's like, we count how much money they have in their thing. Mm-hmm. And then then you know how much money. And two people are always involved. So I'll go with a cashier. I don't do a cashier job, but I go with them and then we count the money. And we're always both there with the money at the same time because it's not like we don't trust a specific person, but it's just like, hey, it's good for two people. If money starts going missing, then they're like, oh, who was working?
Right.
Who was accountable? And so I feel like in that drug lab, like if they just had two people working, I mean, unless it was, they'd be like starting to get addicted in twos. Like, I don't know if that would, like, hey, you gotta check this out. But
That's what was crazy. They hadn't had an audit in over 10 years.
Oh, what?
Right. Like, and the time they had an audit, that's when she poured water into drugs because she was so scared. She was panicking because she's like, this is the one thing I didn't expect. Someone's checking the drugs, right? she poured water in the drugs. The drug she had poured it in was like an oily type drug, so the water and the drug separated, so you could see the water in the drug, but the person checking it apparently just thought that the drug had degraded over the years and that the sample this was just erosion of the sample, and they just threw it away. And then the other thing was, there were four people working in the lab, four, doing all of this testing for Massachusetts. Three of them did test, and then one of them did intake, basically. So you basically have zero oversight. The lab wasn't sterile. It's nothing like, I think there's an image of the criminal justice system that we are sold, right, through TV shows and
CSI, Law and Order.
You know, you watch Miami CSI and the guy can like put on a special set of sunglasses in the lab and like take a picture of like tire tracks, and it'll show you like, and that's a 1984 Plymouth, you know, right? Like, they can do that. And so in our minds, there's like this thing that's happening where like all the cops and all the people are like, it's like diligently working and so smart and putting it all together. And then in real life, you look at this dingy ass lab, you're like, how was not every sample corrupted? Where was the oversight? Why weren't things double checked? How can someone just like, you know, take 100 grams of cocaine and it's missing and no one ever knows that? Like, things like this should not happen in a world where this is the outcome of someone's life.
And I think for me, what's so funny is that somewhere like that, that's very important, like drugs, don't get audited. Me at my normal regular ass job, and I've had multiple of them, sometimes you get audited multiple times a year,
right,
by the federal government and or a company that your company hired to audit you to be sure that you can pass the federal shit. And when they audit, they check for random shit, they check for any flaws, they check for shit that don't look right. They'll, you know, because we've had audits where they'll find like a glitch, and then they next thing you know, the rules change, people's permissions to the system change, all types of shit. And this is just for a regular, that has nothing to do with drugs now, nothing to do with drugs,
right?
But something like this, that is life and death and people going to jail, they're like, fuck it, we'll check it whenever we feel like it. I don't understand that.
Yeah, it was insane, man. Like, I tell people, man, like, check those type of documentaries out every once in a while if you can stand it. I know it makes some people get so mad they can't watch it, and I'm not blaming you for that. I just there's certain things in my life I really like to be informed, right? Because I need to know this is happening, because to a certain extent that anger and that vigilance is fueled by that, and that's kind of what you need in order to continue to kind of like make people accountable, as Mike said, you know, so you can be like, hey guys, this is terrible and this is what this is, you know. Because I think one of the things, you know, I make jokes about it, but one of the things I think when people hear like prison abolition, what they hear is like, get out of jail free, ollie ollie oxa free, nothing's gonna happen to people. And I think and it's also because sometimes that's the way it's sold online, is like, you know, because it's hard to sell nuance and some long-winded thing online. It's easier to be like, you know, let everybody out, and then everybody goes, no. You're like, let a lot of people out, and they're like, okay, maybe a lot of people,
at least some people. How about the innocent people, right? We can get,
yeah. Okay, can we start with some people are in there and shouldn't be in there? Yes, that's probably true.
We I'm listening,
right? I mean,
but who's to say,
right? I mean, the system, right? And so it's like, watch this documentary, you'll see like how this system works, because it was very result oriented, by which I mean, once we had the result of guilty, they were done with these people. It didn't fucking matter if they, it didn't matter if everything that got them to the guilty part was wrong. We have you in custody now. You're in somewhere where we control you. We're gonna do as much as we can to make sure that doesn't change.
That's a win for them, and they don't want to take that win off their record,
yeah,
even though they won for the wrong side. It's like, I heard a thing once about, like, relationships. Like, if you're in, let's say, the wrong relationship, like a relationship that's harmful to you, or certainly not as fulfilling, but, like, you know, isn't good for you. But we have the ideal in our society, a lot of people do, of, like, that it's good to be in a relationship, even to be in one. I feel like Chris Rock has a joke where he's like, better to be in a bad relationship than no relationship. And that's, maybe he's being facetious, but certainly the truth is, I would say that's, I mean, and it's so complex and I'm right. doubling back on everything, but there are definitely relationships that it would be better to not be in. Like some right. people are, feel alone when they're alone. Some people feel alone or lonely when they're in a relationship right. and that's worse. And so the analogy I heard is like, imagine like a ladder up a building and you've climbed up this ladder and you like, that's what I do. And you get to the top and you're like, oh no, I'm on the wrong building. So yeah. to be on the right building, like you can't jump. You gotta go down. You gotta seemingly undo. You're like, right. but that's going backwards, but it's going backwards down the wrong path. So it's right. actually right to go, but you're moving forwards towards the right ladder against the right house so you can be on top of the right building. And so similarly, these, you know, if you have quotas or if you have a right. system where you're like, we did it, we got these guilties, we got, even if, but they're not, wouldn't it be better to undo a not guilty verdict of the person?
Yeah. It culminated in this like, it's really like dramatic moment where like the defense attorneys finally were getting their day in court, in like Supreme Court or whatever, right? Like it was like they were in like the state Supreme Court. They had to fight it that long. Like, and you know, people have died at this point. People have like done their sentences and been out, all this stuff. And he was asking I think it was the DA and then the person who was, over the state's trial of Sonya, the woman who was a drug addict who worked in the lab. And the judge kind of was looking at the work of the original trial. He was like, you guys kind of prosecuted her and gave her 18 months without ever looking into what she did wrong. Like, it's just kind of like her saying, I did some things wrong. And they were like, we'll take your word for it. 18 months, you know?
Oh, yeah. We didn't look, because if we looked, we were sure we would have found stuff that then we would have had to take. We didn't want to do more work.
We're not going to go back 14 years. So how long you been doing the job on drugs? 6 months. Sounds good to us. So that was how they kind of did it. And so and then, of course, you know, in our justice system, prosecutors are supposed to hand over whatever evidence they have to defense attorneys. I think it's called exculpatory evidence or something. So it's like, this evidence might not help our case, but it's the truth, and the point of a trial is to get to the truth. So yeah, this might not make our client look that great. Here's the evidence we have from your side. And the defense attorneys are supposed to do vice versa, right? Now obviously it doesn't always work like that, but in this case they had evidence of like from her car that was saying like her taking files home, her journal and stuff from her her like drug addiction, like I forget what it's called, but like, you know, like her therapy and stuff, like, you know how do you feel about this and how long have you been using that and did you use today and stuff like that. They were like, yeah, that stuff isn't relevant. So they didn't hand over any of that. And then at the very end, there's this dramatic moment and the defense attorney finally has like the DA and the assistant DA like on the stand. And he asked her flat out, like, so did you not find this evidence that you didn't hand over to be relevant to the fact that this woman had tested all this stuff for like 14 years or whatever? And she was like, no, just flat out no. And it was such a blatant lie, and the judge got mad, and it was, you know, obviously throughout all these cases and stuff. So, you know, in the end, that a lot of people kind of quote unquote won Pyrrhic victories or whatever, and victories, I mean, because that record, that thing on your record can really hurt your life. So but it was that moment where she said no that really just like summed it all up. It's like, we don't want to admit this was wrong or bad or a loss, because that would mean our entire system was wrong and bad and at a loss in this situation. So they ended up getting like reassigned and all this stuff. But it was just such a like compelling documentary. So if you guys get a chance, check it out. It's called How to Fix a Drug Scandal.
Hey Mike, how do you find so much time to volunteer? Because talking to you, sound like you have doing a lot of volunteer time. I was like, oh, he does a lot of outside work. It's actually really neat to hear about.
I'm glad. I'm happy to make it sound that way. And, like, look how good I am. I actually just saw yesterday, my friend Ramin Nazer, wonderful comedian and artist. I recommend following him on Instagram. He posts these beautiful, like, colorful, philosophical, psychedelic, like, creative, just beautiful art pieces. And yesterday's was just, like, you know, a nice scene of just a human holding a sign. That was basically saying, I think the sign said, be good. And the guy was like, all right, I've done my job. You know, I'm a good person. And so I'm that guy right now holding this sign. Like, so what, before I will answer your question, but I also do want to offer one piece of, I think, hope in a way about, that I thought about CSI, because I heard this thing years ago that once CSI became so popular, like somebody I met who worked in like either a CSI type of job or in the courts was like, now that people have seen the show, they are expecting a higher, more exact standard of evidence presentation collection. Because on the show, it's always like, aha, we have the answer. Mm-hmm. We analyzed the thing. It's this person. And it's so much more the same way the labs are cleaner, the results are cleaner. And it's in some ways a matter of statistics. You know, even if it's like fingerprints or whatever, like certainly like physical evidence is better than like, I think, eyewitness testimony, which is like wrong at least like a massive percentage of the time. Like so many people arrested in jail because somebody said, and it's just a person who didn't like them or didn't see them or was racist or whatever it was. Like, and I mean, that's the thing, like, let people out of jail, probably because there's so many people, like, certainly whether or not you think people deserve to be in jail, and certainly there are people who have done harms to people that were like, what do we do? Like, it would be great to put them on an island where they could only hurt themselves or another person that also hurt people, whatever it is, but certainly there are people who didn't do anything who are there, but, so that's sort of like the silver lining that when I was told this story, I was on the side of this person. I was like, oh man, that's horrible that you now have a harder time getting juries to convict people. And now I'm like, oh, what a beautiful life, life path that I've been on, that I'm like, oh, that's a silver lining now, that if juries are a little more, have higher standards for putting people away for extended periods of
it's
time.
We've taken the, long way back to OJ Simpson's DNA trial, where it's like, like OJ got off because no one understood DNA or trusted it at the time, and then like, but then after a while, because of TV and stuff, we've all gotten to the point where we're like, DNA, that's it, that's the end of the thing, dog. You're going to jail, you know. And now it's like we're back to like, well, I don't know, I saw an episode of SVU and it's not what you think. You know.
Yeah, like real life DNA evidence, like a real life, like CSI, my lifey, like real life, you know, would be like a boring show. People would be like, okay, how long does this take and what is happening and what are they doing? But, to answer your question, I mean, I'm grateful that I have, like, you know, I don't have a day job now. Especially now I really don't have a day job, but, since, you know, I started doing comedy in 2002 and I moved to New York in 2008, and around then is when I started mostly essentially just traveling for comedy for my life. And so then, like, now I would say I'm traveling, in the before times and hopefully in the after times. I would say about half the time, I'm on the road, like maybe a few weekends a month, or, you know, fly out to do a few colleges 1 week and then come home. So like a few days out, a few days back, a few days out, a few days back, sometimes gone for a week or two. But I would say on average, you know, maybe half the time away and half the time home. So when I'm home, like I'm doing shows at night, but during the day, you know, I'm doing my own like things, work, like, you know, and non-work things like life, hobbies, and like, over the past several years, especially, you know, like for me, I'd say like the 2016 election was the largest wake up call in my own personal life that, oh, it's not as okay as I thought. I was sheltered, and it hasn't been okay for, in many ways, for a lot of people for a long, long time. And, like I love Roy Wood Jr.'s comedy, like his special father figure, where he's talking about like, the blues, and he's like, you know, oh, black people have been, we've been sad for a while, you know, we've been, it's been there, we've been trying to tell you, you know? And so the idea of, you know, that I'm like, oh, what can I do, you know, started mostly, that, you know, like I always donated to like charities that I cared about, and you know, I've been vegan for 18 years and have, you know, done like fundraisers for different animal rights and different and human rights fundraisers and things like what I can, you know, I've done what I can when asked about it, but I've been looking into it more. Mm-hmm. And I have like some very good friends who have always been doing more, you know, mm-hmm. in the activism world and activism circles. And so I've like asked them like, oh, what do you do? Like, what meetings do you go to? Like, I have a friend in LA who goes to like White People for Black Lives, which, you know, is sort of like helps support Black Lives Matter in their events and experiences and actions is the word I'm looking for. And so in New York, I've gone to some Surge meetings and some other, you know, and I think it was through Surge that I found, Court Watch. And I was like, this seems like at least a concrete, it's nice to be able to have a concrete thing to go to and do and be like, well, at least I'm incrementally adding to a cause that I think at least seems to be heading in a direction that makes sense to me, like towards like ending mass incarceration in the form that it exists today. And so when I went to do the Court Watch training, maybe a year, a little over a year ago, They said, we'd love it if you could volunteer, like the shifts are 3 hours, like at least 2 a month would be good. I mean, obviously it's volunteer. And so whenever I'm home, if I'm home for a weekend, I'll go on like Saturdays at 2 p.m. is one of the sessions. And so I can still do shows at night, but I can still contribute at that time. So if I was home every Saturday a month, maybe I would do every Saturday, but so I'll either do sometimes it's one, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's two. And then there's also like data entry that can happen like from home. So I've done some of those shifts as well. So I guess basically like, you know, several years ago, before I started meditating, I was like, meditation? Who has time for that? Who has time to take 10 minutes for myself to do nothing, quote unquote, to just sit for 20 minutes? Like I could watch a garbage TV show. Like they're not going to watch themselves. Like they kind of will, maybe, who knows, in the future, like make AI to watch the shows. But I was like, now I feel like, oh, taking that time in the day for myself, or, you know, for it's, I hopefully, it makes me more capable of then being able to take time in other ways for myself, for other people, for all of us, because I think, I mean, another quote unquote good thing, a silver lining of this experience. My girlfriend just told me, the other day or today even, like it, her friend shared with her something that, a spiritual teacher had shared with her. And I don't know the original source, but it's like, don't look for silver linings, look for the light. And so in this experience, like another thing that light comes from, or light can be shined on, is we all are in this together. Like literally, if we're in it together, we're in it. Right. So stay away from it. Stay away from each other, and we can be positively impacted. Like our health, like rich, you know, and obviously, it's not just that rich people and poor people, or white people and black people, are impacted the same, of course, because the system is still protecting, it is happening that if you are powerful, then you are safer. And if you can't stay home, then you are not. And if you have a job where, or don't have it, whatever the case is, but we are all at risk. In it together, and to protect all of us, to protect ourselves is to help protect other people. To protect other people is also to protect ourselves. Right. Like, it's kind of the simplest Buddhist thing.
The thing, you know, about the virus is that it doesn't care about any of the shit. You know, like I saw today, and I was gonna make a joke about it, but I've decided to be to not. But it was like a guy who did one of those rallies that was like, yeah, man, we're not doing social distancing, I don't give a fuck. And he died today. He actually died a couple of days ago, and then it just came out today. And I was just like, this shit doesn't care. Like, it's not, it's not like a, like, the virus doesn't vote. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's just there, like, ooh,
it
look.
It doesn't have a D or R beside it.
Yeah, it's just like membranes, woo! And it's just hopping in different membranes regardless. Yeah. Now, there are some people who are more at risk than others, but then to, like, voluntarily put yourself at risk, it's not gonna just be warded off by your confidence. It's just, it's like, cool, I would take any mucous membranes I can find. So anyone that wants to touch their face and be very close to people, this is my shit, okay? This is what I'm into.
This is my jam.
So it's been interesting to see that happen, too. Like, the other thing I was gonna ask you, a couple of notes. One, it's funny, white people for black lives sounds like what slavery used to be, right? It was like, I'd like two black lives, please. Thank you.
Oh, yes.
As a white person. like, I wonder if anyone ever shows up to the wrong meeting. They're just like, you guys got black lives for sale up in here? And they're like, no. This is the opposite of that.
Oh, wrong meeting.
And then the other thing, do you ever read, like, I know you talked about reading. Do you ever read, like, comic books and stuff, or no?
I 100% do. Let me just put a quick button on the reason I brought up the fact that we're all in this together, great for its own sake, 100%. And it is also what allows me, like, I now understand how much I have, like how much I've always had. Like, you know, my parents were teachers. I was raised in a home, like, that I had a home, I had food, I was cared for, I was loved. And I still am in a home with a person who loves me. Like, I have so much, and, you know, I have a savings account. Like, so many people don't. So many people have credit card debt and college debt and all these things. And, like, I have a house. I could, based on your most recent question, I could turn this camera, if it wasn't my laptop, sideways, and you'd see, like, a shelves full of graphic novels. I've got so much in my life that I'm grateful for. And it seems important. I've learned, like, I mean, I learned in one way growing up, like my mother, you know, I talked to recently, she's like, we always, you know, emphasized kindness, being kind to others, treating people the way they want to be treated. And then it's only in, like, recent years that I've gotten, like, more specific examples of how to do that, of, you know, and who can we help, and why, and how we can, because, I mean, society, religion, human nature is something that maybe divides people into, like, it's a, like, black and white, and, you know, into right and wrong, into criminals, and, you know, people who aren't, you know.
Right. Oh, Mike froze for a little bit. Hold on. I don't know if we, lost him there. Let me pause.
But to me, okay. I see one of you all moving right. And one of you not.
Okay, Mike is back. Oh, wait, hold on. Now, I'm... Mike, you there? Sorry about that, man.
Oh, you're all good. What's the last thing you heard?
Let's see. You were talking about being kind, and...
Yeah. So I grew up, and I feel like that was emphasized in my home, but the specifics are what I feel like in recent years... I mean, not that my mom was just like, be kind and figure it out, but that, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. Like, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't go to, like, political protests. Right. But now I will go to political protests, because now I'm like, oh, that's a thing that people I respect and care about, and who are active in circles that I'm like, oh, I can do that. Like, and not, you know, marches aren't the only thing that are important, but there's something. And then these, you know, different organizations, I'm like, it's now more worth my time. Like, I, you know, time is a luxury that I have because of the good fortune that I've had in my life from the beginning and in my career more recently. And so it seems valuable to, like, it used to be like, you know, well, what's, you know, it seems like there's, when you're doing something, you're not doing something else.
Right.
And so that's where sometimes FOMO comes from. But if you're doing something that you think is important or valuable, either for yourself or someone else, because, like, I don't have kids and I don't specifically plan to have kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's like at the end of this body and this life's incarnation, like, that, you know, there's nothing, no physical things coming with me. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the experiences that I'm having. And my friend who I mentioned before, Ramin Nazer, had this, he has a Patreon with extra art. And one of them recently was about how everything that you're doing, like, you might be during these times being like, ooh, I'm going to be very creatively active. Mm-hmm. Or if you're not, you might be like, oh, I'm going to spend time with my family, or I'm going to be working, or I'm going to be, you know, just trying to deal with it. Just mm-hmm. whatever you're doing, he says, is like, that's a branch of who you are. That's a creative manifestation of your desires, of your, you know, of who you are and what you can do. So if I see a friend who's like, I've been working on my comedy, for like writing 7 hours a day, I've been working on my novel 7 hours a day, like, that's great. And even if I'm not doing that, that's okay, because I'm doing my quality and quantity of work. And also, these people are doing their versions of spending time with their loved ones, being engaged in activism. And so if, you know, several times a month, I have 3 hours that maybe I would have gone and seen a movie. Like, I think part of the answer is I see fewer movies now, which, is also mostly because of the coronavirus, because I was for a little while. I did that AMC movie, you know, you can see for a curtain.
The movie pass.
But that was making me see movies that I didn't even want to see, because I'm like, well, I got to get my money's worth. But true. So now I'm like, I'm going to pay to see a movie when I want to see a movie. And at a time when I would have gone to see a movie just for no reason, I'll be like, oh, if I can spend this 3 hours volunteering, it seems more valuable to do like one fewer movie a month, or two fewer movies a month, or just watch the movie later at night when I'm going to go to sleep. And, I realize, like, I make lists of movies that I want to see. And like years later, I'll be like, oh, these are movies I wanted to see in 2015. Do I still want to see them? If I do, I'll watch them now. Right. If I don't, great, great bonus. And so yeah, comic books are something that I've been reading my whole life, or at least since, like, I read Archie comics as a kid. I read, like, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as a kid.
Yeah,
like, sort of
too.
Like the sanitized, colorful ones. And then maybe I read
the black and white Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. My mom, you would take us to Barnes and Noble, and I always go to the graphic novel section. And I did not know how hardcore they were. The original Eastman and Liard, like, they were like cutting people's heads off, like cussing, and like, I fell in love with that version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And then, like, of course, every other version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for kids, right? So it's all like, you know, Michelangelo's a party dude and all this stuff. And I'm just like, like, I was the only kid that was like bitter and cynical already, where I was just like, aren't the real Ninja Turtles, man. Okay, let me tell you about this shit, man.
It's like the Bible, you know? It's
right,
like, you learn it, like, I went to Sunday school at my synagogue growing up, and you learn, and then later in life, you're like, oh, everybody was like murdering each other.
Yeah.
And there was so much sex involved,
right.
Or like Columbus coming to America, like history, like everything that's for kids is like, later they're like, okay, that was just kidding.
Yeah, well, like, but when you're a kid, you're just like, yeah, and his wife turned to a pillar of salt, and you're like, man, that's crazy, salt. And then when you get older, you're like, wait, Sodom? Is that where sodomy comes from? You know, like that type of shit. But what I was gonna say is, there's this book I started reading, it's a graphic novel I started reading, not even graphic novel, it's a comic book, but I started reading it a while ago, maybe like this week, and it's called Animosity. And
I've seen that in the stores. I haven't read it yet. You like it?
Oh my god, it's so you know, I do eat animals occasionally. Animosity is like, what if all the animals became sentient? And it kind of did fuck me up a little bit, because I was like, damn, we treat animals like shit. But it was only like, because animals aren't quote unquote as smart as us, but like, once the animals became able to relay more complex feelings about things that we do to them already, because the animals could remember everything that was done. So it wasn't like the animals became sentient and from that moment on they were like, wait a minute, they became sentient and they were like, you fucking sold my cubs. I like, what was that? You know what I mean? And so, it made me think about you when I read it. I was like, oh man, Mike might want to check it out. I don't, you know, I kind of had written it off as like something silly, because it just seemed kind of like the covers and stuff all seemed silly. But now that I have infinite time, I was like, I guess I'll read it. And then I was like, oh, this is actually pretty cool, man. And, even within the animals, I got to an issue, the last one I'm reading, where even amongst the animals, they started having a hierarchy, because there's animals, obviously, you know, like we think cats, dogs, raccoons, whatever, right? We think animals, we think, but then like the bees, who are the most important like species on the earth,
come on, they go, we all go,
right? And so the bees are insects, and then there was like kind of a disregard for them from even other animals. They were like, they're insects, they don't count. And it's like the bees became sentient. So so now it's like we're enslaving bees if we like take the queen and make our own hive and all of this stuff. So like it was just like a super deep way to think of the way that we kind of exist in this ecosystem. Now I don't know what they're gonna do if the plants become sentient, because that's probably gonna really fuck everything up, because it's like, dude, what are we gonna eat? Like, what is, how's everyone gonna live now?
I hear you, and I think that this kind of like, you know, spectrum of sentient conscious of consciousness experience, like, is, I mean, it's real. Like, you know, animals are sentient, like they right. they have emotions, they have thoughts, they move through the world, you know, the same, like, we are animals. And so there's I think that the answer to the question, sort of like with mass incarceration, you know, if you're like, let them all out, like right. At the extremes, it doesn't, what do? We don't know, like, how do we get here from here to there? Like, because also animals eat each other. Like, that is right. part of the natural order of things. Like, the way that humans eat animals with factory farms right. and with unnecessary cruelty, like, we don't need to eat animals at all. Certainly, we don't need to torture them the way that we right. do before we kill them. So I feel like, you know, the indigenous version of like the way, you know, people would be aware of and thankful to, you know, the animals' participation in the cycle right. of existence, of nature, of life. Like, I'm not, I certainly wouldn't say that, you know, we're all nature, we're all part of nature. And it's not like, it's like, how are you doing? What are you doing? What are you going to do? And I mean, also right now, like, I'm a person who has ingested, plants for psychedelic, purposes. Mm-hmm. And, the understanding, like, some of it is like, plants have information or wisdom or knowledge or something, because like, you're doing this, you're engaging with this plant liquid food drink thing, this plant consciousness is, you know, becoming like, you are, is it all you? Is it you? It's certainly you and the plant, like the plant right. is helping you.
There's definitely a something. Chemical reaction that's happening because of the plant, like you ingesting the plant. So it's not just all you, right? It's not like if you sat down by yourself sans plant, you would have the same experience, right? Like, I know I've heard you talk about like ayahuasca before. So like, it's definitely, you know, due to the chemical reaction that comes from doing the thing, right?
And so it's, I think some people have postulated or theorized the idea that like, maybe this is how plants are communicating with us. And
shit.
Also, like, sometimes the way the cycle works, in order for some plants to be propagated, is they have to be like eaten and then either excreted or there's various, like, I'm certainly not an expert in it, but right. I did have a woman on my podcast named Sophia. And her last name escapes me right now, but she wrote a book, or was a co-writer of a book called When Plants Dream, I believe. And it's all about like the history and current like sort of sociology, anthropology of ayahuasca, and about how it's been used throughout history, and about how, you know, different cultures that are in the Amazon jungle now are kind of threatened by what's happening to the Amazon jungle. But like, we talked so much about ayahuasca and the ways in which it's sort of, you know, a cooperation, with plants. And so I don't want, you know, to be like, I certainly don't want, I think it's important to be thoughtful right. about what we are doing, why we are doing it, and like how much we're doing it. Because certainly, even if, you know, you're living at a time when, you know, if you're living somewhere and to live, the only thing you could do is fish or, you know, kill an animal, long, long ago, then like that's something, like that's a more meaningful, connected, like experience of of presence with it, as opposed to like the way where we are now, where food, you know, is either delivered or in a box. You know, it might not, we're not even calling it. Like, I have a friend, my friend Sarah, asks people sometimes, do you eat chickens? Plural, you know, as opposed to, because even saying chicken, we're like, oh, you know, the mass, the blob, the substance.
Right.
Like, do you eat that thing, that stuff? He's like, no, do you eat chickens? Like the animals that you are familiar with and walk around? Because humans are good at, I was on a podcast yesterday, so I'm very knowledgeable about this thing that I'm about to say. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I learned, I think there's an anthropologist named Bruno Latour who said that a good thing that humans are good at is creating like language, creating structures, creating systems, and then immediately forgetting that we created them and acting like they are to be revered and like sort of worshipped, and being like, you know, with, let's say, gender pronouns, be like people who are like, what? Why do I have to learn a made up pronoun? Like, every pronoun is a made up pronoun. Right. Every part of language was constructed, so that's why it would be a very reasonable thing to learn a new one, because you learned the old ones. Everyone was created. And so with respect to the way that animals are treated, we're like, oh, well, this is just how it is. Or like with every system, this is just how it is. This racist, sexist, homophobic system, it's the way it's always been. In fact, it's actually been, hopefully, in many ways, growing and changing and improving from generation to generation, because there are people who answer, well, this is how it is, to, well, does it have to be that way then?
Right, exactly.
And you know what, baby? You might actually get your comic book because about the animals. Because apparently animals are like coming out the woodworks and like camping, and like the bear population doesn't survive. You got mooses walking in the middle of the street and foxes. Like, some people, depend on how far in the country they are, gonna come out, and they're gonna have to like fight the animals in order to get society back to running again.
Well, I like the book because it teases so many concepts that I just didn't like, things that happen between humans all the time that I just didn't think about with animals, obviously, you know, like one of the main characters when it starts is like this guy, he's a veterinarian. And so his whole job is like taking care of animals, making sure they live, treating them well. And then this guy was making a joke about, he's like, you're a veterinarian, but like you eat burgers. And he's like, yeah, I, you know, that is kind of like a contradiction, but also like a thing that I've been doing my whole life, right? And then like later you kind of see through his eyes that he's a veterinarian, but then he also believes in this hierarchy of like humans over animals, essentially. And he becomes like jealous of his own pet dog's relationship with his daughter, because the dog is like closer to his daughter than he is to a certain extent, and now this dog can speak and express it, and you know, like, so there's like all this little stuff that happens. Like, there's a group of humans who then join up with animals, but then they become this alliance because they still want to eat other animals. You know, so there's not like a it's like they're together, but they're fucked up, you know what I mean? Like, so I don't know, it's like an interesting book to make you just think about certain shit.
Oh yeah, it reminds me of probably, like, this isn't covered as much, like it seems like the point of that is that book is that those philosophical ideas, like BoJack Horseman is like another show where there's like humans and animal type humans like all interacting, and every once in a while like they will like have a character maybe like eat or bite or like something, like they'll reference that these are animals who would be, if they were simply animals, you know, not necessarily all getting along. And I'm always like, I wonder what they're eating for lunch in this world.
It's like BoJack had a salad, I understand, but why is that tiger having a salad? I don't know.
And speaking of tigers, I also was just gonna say, a tiger in New York, I think we're in a zoo somewhere, just got the coronavirus. So it's like we're in it together. It's not even just humans. Like this virus is like, you know, uniting us all in a way that we're like, well, what do we do? How do we do it? But it's good to be made to ask these questions.
I'll definitely be social distancing from tigers. That one,
oh yeah, 100%.
Absolutely. I've been doing that my whole life, and
I'm
only like
7 feet. Yeah.
Yeah, I was born for that. The other thing you referenced a couple of times now that you have a girlfriend. I think we talked about this last time you were on, which was ages ago. But, you know, are you down to just the one girlfriend now, Mike? Are you like really cutting back on on the girlfriends. I know you used to like, and this is doesn't mean you're not an advocate for it, but just I know you used to be heavy into like kind of talking about polyamory and stuff.
Great question. I like the way that you asked. Like, I'm on a relationship diet. I've cut down to one, and I was like, "Ooh, I gotta get all this we like to snack, like, but when it gets down to it, this is nice. I'm actually gonna take that down as a note for a joke for later. Hold on, cut down. All right, perfect podcasting. My girlfriend and I are monogamous. I would still say that I support, like, in the same way there's this, I love this Lenny Bruce quote. He says, I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. Right. And also, he is a comedian, but he's not just a comedian, and maybe sometimes he's not a comedian, but he's always Lenny Bruce, and sometimes Lenny Bruce is a comedian. And so my girlfriend's name is Rini. And so I say, like, we're not polyamorous. We're Mike and Rini. Like, we're not in a kind of a relationship. Like, our relationship actually did begin. I met her when I was in another open relationship. I was in an open relationship living with a girlfriend 4 years ago. I met Rini. And we started seeing each other I told her all about the relationship I was in. And then that relationship ended of its own, you know, reasons. And then a year, maybe 6 months later, after dating for, you know, sort of just still casually and also seeing other people and being essentially single, my girlfriend was in, we stopped seeing each other. And for a few months, she was in a monogamous relationship with somebody else. And there was a joke that I wrote at the time, he turned out to be, controlling and not a good partner for her. Mm. And there were maybe signs of that, maybe even in that, like, everyone was fine, like, in the beginning, like, we were all doing our thing. And so I was like, when she was like, I'm going to be with this guy because, like, he will only wants to be with me and he doesn't want me seeing other people. And so I felt like I was torn because I wanted to say, like, don't go off and be with the controlling mean guy. Stay with me, the controlling nice guy.
Right, you know?
And so, but she had the experience of being with that person. And then after that ended, she got back in touch with me and we started seeing each other again. And it was open for a little bit, but we moved in together. And just over the course of the relationship, we had conversations that eventually led us to be monogamous. And there are people who I've talked to who are like, I told you, that's the way, that's the right way to do it. And if I had been a monogamous person the whole time, like, it doesn't even make sense,
right?
Because then I wouldn't have even started dating her.
Yeah.
Because when I met her, I was dating another person. So it was like, the point is, this relationship is, in some ways, I feel like I have like my manager is an older man, like he's like, you know, in his maybe 50s, I think. Maybe he just turned 50. And he has, you know, a wife and kids and from the outside, at least, a more conventional life experience relationship-wise. And I remember, you know, for the past decade, I'd say I was either in open relationships or moving towards being in open relationships, some monogamous things, but some, it was like, you know, I was on a journey that I was like, open relationships seem valuable because I'd been in a monogamous marriage and that ended. And I was like, ooh, I don't think I can be with one person forever. And so I was like, so a joke I wrote then was like, oh, so I'll just, I'm just looking for the one that will let me be with others. And that was I was like, maybe I'll just be in short relationships, you know, like a couple years, I can do a couple years and then another couple years with another person. And so as it turns out, like, I feel like my manager was a person who was like, when you meet the right person that makes you want to settle down, then you'll know. I'm making him sound silly, but he was like, it's just like, it happened for me and it could happen for you. And in some ways, I feel like it turns out, I think coincidentally, to be right. I might never have met this person. I'm so grateful that I did, but this is a person that I want to be with no matter what the relationship structure is.
Right.
Like, I don't want, like, for some people, I was like, it's important for me to be able to see, to be able to be open to meeting and connecting with and maybe being romantically and or sexually involved with other people. And so I wouldn't start being in a relationship with a person unless they also at least understood that or were on board with that. And so this relationship is one where my girlfriend did, she understood that completely and was on board with that. And we did that. And so the same way that as a human being and as a comedian and in all the ways I have grown and like learned and changed and had different experiences, in this relationship, I've been as surprised as anyone that I was like, I thought I couldn't be with a person forever, like just one person. But it turns out that it wasn't that, it was that relationship. It was that marriage wasn't the right marriage for me. The one that I had and the one that I had, the one that I have now, we're not married, but I'm talking, like we're talking, we talk about it all the time. Like my newest hour of comedy, like the album, AKA that's out now, the new hour that I've written since then that I'm, you know, if once I start touring again that I've been touring, like was going to go to Edinburgh with this year, will go with next year. It, ideally, if all things go according to plan, we develop herd immunity, we all socially distance enough and flatten the curve, they develop a vaccine. Like in the later times, in the after times, in the future where there's touring again, the hour that I'm making now is all about like my growth in relationship, my, and this person, my love, with Rini specifically. And so it's to the point where I've learned, like it was even like when we talked about monogamy to begin with, I was like, okay, like let's do this for this reason. And we'll, in some ways it's an experiment. We'll see. And it's,
but the isn't like, isn't every relationship an experiment if you think about it? I mean, like, I think what's interesting is like, maybe people weren't quote unquote right in the way that they think they're right, right? Because like, you're gonna meet somebody, you're gonna do this, and this is the right way to do it, and you're gonna figure it. And it's like, well, they're not necessarily right as much as like, maybe this is for you right now. You know what I mean? Like, it's like saying, like, there'll be a time when you like chocolate cake, and it's like, I hate chocolate cake. And then, like, I don't know, 6 years later, I'm like, chocolate cake's not that bad. You know? But then maybe 6 years after that, I'm like, fuck chocolate cake. I had chocolate cake. You know, I'm over chocolate cake. So, it's kind of interesting how people, like, and I think it's because we've been indoctrinated, right? Like, so much of, especially American, but pretty much all over the globe, so much of like society is just like monogamy and two people and then you have some kids and then you do this. But then like the people are not like these fixed structures that just stay in one place their whole lives and stay on one path and there's only one way to do it, right? You get married and you have some kids and you get, you know, you get the house and you get the job and you like, there's so many divergent paths and so many different like versions of us that we could be at any given time. So it feels kind of weird that people would even like, like there is like a slight resistance to be like, damn, I almost don't want to even tell you guys because you're gonna feel like you're right, but you're not necessarily, you weren't wrong, but you weren't necessarily right for the way that you think you were right.
Well, yeah, I that's all very 100% resonant. And because it's not one thing, it is nuanced. It is like it's, there is no one answer, there is no one destination. Like, I mean, I know it sounds corny to say like that it's a journey, but the fact is that like there are people for whom like polyamory is like, for me, it was the right thing for me for a time, or that was my desire, that was my goal, that was, and you know, I did it the best that I could and sometimes not the best, and now I'm, you know, with my girlfriend in this relationship, and this relationship is the relationship. It is like the one. And also like the good news is I realized that, you know, you're like, oh, chocolate cake every day, but the cake changes as well. Like you change, your taste change, and also the cake change. Like maybe it'll be a carrot cake in 6 years. It'll look different and sound different. And like that's the wonderful thing, is the two flip sides of like, oh, only with one person. Well, it's a growing, changing person.
You're never
reading things and having experiences. Sorry, man.
You're never actually loving the same person. Like I, you know, like me and Karen, we've been together since we were 16, and then people always go like, like, how the fuck you do that? You know, whatever. But I'm like, but it's Karen at 16 is not Karen at 40.
Oh no,
you know what I mean?
I'm a completely different person.
And neither am I, you know? So like you kind of grow together, or you know, sometimes people grow apart and all that stuff. And I think one of the things that is kind of messed up is that we teach kids and we teach each other through whether it's religion or just the way we kind of like socialize, or even the government to a certain extent, we teach people like you're supposed to be this way all the time forever at this moment. So like the moment you say I do, from that point on you are that person only forever. I, you know, you see people say like really normally it's misogynistic shit, like, you know, I marry my wife at 98 pounds, she gonna be 98 pounds forever, you know, something as silly as that, you know, is like kind of, but it points out the fallacy of how we think about life and love,
right.
My friend Rashida, when we were in high school, she said something and I mocked her for it at the time, and I go back to this all the time. It was like, I was wrong, you know. I even told her, you know, later in life, like, I was so wrong about this shit, I didn't know what I was thinking. But she told me she was dating this guy, and I said I didn't like the dude. He was like super stupid and all this shit. I was like, I don't even like this dude, what do you see in this dude? And she was like, you know, like, nah, he's good and he's this and he's that. And I was like, no way. And I was like, you don't love this guy. And she's like, I do love him. I was like, you love this guy? And she was like, yes. And I was like, what is, like, how could you say that? And she's like, I love him for what I know love to be right now.
Right.
And at the time I went, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Rashida, that is so stupid. How can you say that? That's what you say when you don't love someone. And now I go back, I was like, that's all everyone ever does. You just, for how you define it at the moment is what the fuck you know. You don't know anything. You can't know what you're gonna know later.
Right.
You only know what you knew up to this point and how you live for now. So you kind of get fortunate, and if you continue to live in that, you know, if you continue to live in that, like, that period of time, that little, like, that circle of, like, what I know love to be and the relationship I'm in or not in, right? So yeah, but it's interesting too, because a lot of people that are monogamous meet people while they're monogamous that end up being the quote unquote one, and they don't count that against monogamy. It's always like, it's like no, that's different because now I'm with this person. It's like, well, to me, I always felt like the thing you were really advocating for was really more about communication, you know, like,
yes,
like this, like striving to be like, this is how I feel at this moment. I'm not, maybe I'll feel differently. This is how I felt before. And then we, our promise to each other is to always communicate how we are currently feeling. What are we doing about other relationships, other people? And I think that thing is a one line that goes through every type of relationship that, especially romantically.
Yeah. That's all beautiful and resonant and well put. And I have here's a new phrase that if it already exists, great. If not, I'm putting it out there. Informed monogamy is what I'm into now, like informed by having been non-monogamous, like choosing monogamy after having the option and having lived in a non-monogamous way is more meaningful than just being gifted with it, being told that it is the way. It's nice to have been told that, and then to be like, I don't think that's right. And then later to be like, ah, now in this way, in this time, in this place with this person, it is right. This is right for me. The other couple things I wanted to say in response to what you said, there's to the guy who's like, 98 pounds, that's what she's gonna stay at. Just stay with her. And even if she grows to larger than that, at some point, if you stick around long enough, like she'll eventually, it might be when she's decomposing, but she'll be back.
Yeah.
She'll be,
everyone goes back down.
Skeleton.
Eventually, you know, if you stick around long enough, everyone makes it down to the 98 pounds mark. And yeah, I always thought that was so ridiculous. That was like the when the guys say that, they sound like the guy who like orders for their girlfriend at a restaurant, you know?
Oh yeah.
I'll be ordering for the lady over here.
Yeah, the little lady will have the salad and I'll take 12 steaks. I'm like, dude, you come right out of a comic book. Stop.
Hey man, you should read the comic book Animosity.
Yeah. Then you won't order the steaks and
I'll have 12 salads.
Yeah. And see, that's how we go. I'll be like, I want the steak and potato, and Roger be like, I want the salad.
My head is gonna explode if the fucking lettuce starts talking in like issue 25. I don't know what I'm gonna do. My brain, I'm gonna just be on the couch like, oh my god!
All a dream.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Oh yeah.
So, now hold on, I gotta pause real quick, cause we're gonna get cut off. Alright, we're back. Sorry man, I didn't wanna have to cut you off in case, we would've got to that 2-hour mark.
All good. So the other thing I was gonna say is, when you were talking about, you know, the way that society and pop culture and fairy tales sometimes gift people with the idea that relationships have to only go in one way, one direction. Sometimes that's called the, like, relationship escalator. You know, like, you're dating, you're steady, you're maybe living together, you're engaged, you're married, you have kids. You know, the heteronormative, just like one directional, just ramp to infinity or not infinity. And now, especially with the idea that there are different relationship structures, different, you know, types of non-monogamy, polyamory, different options, it's like there's so many different staircases. It's like an escalator that goes in all different directions, some up, some down. It's like an M.C. Escher thing that I call the M.C. Escalator.
Yeah, there's so many paths that your life can go on, man. I think also, like, if you're if you're learning constantly, then you're changing constantly. And I think because of how we view, I think it's also harmful because of how we learn about monogamy. We also learn to view relationships as successes or failures, you know? So it's not like a lesson learned or something that, some experience that you would take to the next thing. It's like, no, 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 you failed at marriage. You failed at this relationship, you know? Like, sometimes you'll see people talk about, like, their ex, and it's kind of popular to be like, yeah, I saw my ex, and they were in Target, and they were looking bad. Ha, 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 I won. It's like, you know, so it's like, it turns us into these kind of, like, monsters almost. It's like, well, that was a person you liked at one point enough to be with them.
Right.
And now, you know, like, because you're not with them, it seems like you want them to fail, or you want everything, as if that somehow will mean you succeeded in their failure because you're not together and stuff. So I think it's kind of interesting the way we think about just relationships in general, and the way that we define things. And then also there's, like, the other part of it is that even with, like, a polyamorous lifestyle, it's not necessarily a quote-unquote solution to everything. There's rules within that, there's constraints within that, there's freedom within that. Like, it's still, like, it still changes for everybody, but I think we've just been conditioned to see things one way, and that's it, and there's no other way.
Yeah, I would say, like, I've always been, like, a pretty optimistic person. I mean, part of it was, I think, the way that I was raised was, like, you know, safe and sheltered and, you know, in a good environment to have a child. And so that gave me this confidence. I have this joke I'm working on now where I say I'm confident right up until somebody says, are you sure? And then I'm like, no. and so I have this confidence that I'm, like, kind of, you know, earlier in life, at least, was like, well, everything's going okay for me. You know, like, I didn't have all the access to the way things were going for a lot of other people at that time or other times, or even how things would eventually be going for me. Like, everything isn't always just perfect, just roses, just, you know, beauty. Like, we can, you know, hopefully be present and see the challenges as lessons and opportunities for learning and growth. And sometimes it takes being able to look back on it to see that that did happen. But like, here's the thing specifically to what you're saying in my relationship, like, in December, just, you know, 4 months ago, my girlfriend, broke her ankle, like, it badly, like, needed surgery. She has now a plate and, like, several screws in it, like, that were to hold the bones back together because the fibula and tibia both snapped off their ends. And so she was, home for, like, she's, you know, we're all home now, but she was also basically home for several months, and I would, you know, be around mostly caring for, it was like our child. It was like, oh, a new baby that we have to care for. Your ankle. Like, I'll go out and get your ankle food, and, like, if we'll get a babysitter if you need, we'll have somebody just in case you need something from across the room real fast. And the point is, like, I'm grateful, like, I love my girlfriend, and I'm grateful to have been able to have the, you know, like, the resources to help us continue to live when she couldn't go to work and stand and sell jewelry, like, was her job at the time. And and that I could, you know, my, I could only go out to shows when I needed to and be there during the day. And it made, I started thinking like, wow, I mean, I wonder if I was in a polyamorous relationship, if I had other partners, like imagine, I mean, one good thing is like, maybe there'd be more people around if you have like a triad to care, to care for the children, to care for the people. But what if two people, like right now, what if you're in a poly triad and like two people are sick, like, and you're one person caring for, and I'm not saying like, of course, we have our extended families, potentially your biological or your logical, your chosen family, and you have friends and people that you care for in different ways, but like we only have so much, it's not that we have so much love, but we have so much time and energy and resources and the capacity to care for someone. So I was particularly extra grateful for the monogamousness of my relationship at the time when I was like, it's important for me to be here with this person, caring for them in this way all of the time.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like one of the things they're saying about the social distancing and quarantine stuff is that a lot of people are going to come out of it and there's going to be a wave of like divorces and breakups and stuff because of, you know, it's such a shock to the system and a change to what people are able to do daily. You know, hey, normally you might leave the house for 8 hours a day, do a job and come back. And that's part of it too, right? Like that's that for some people, that's the thing that's helping, is to be like, I like 24 hours concentrated of you is not, is too much. You know, but like 16 hours, I can, you know, that's the perfect amount or whatever. And I think, so the thing I think about all the time is like, we don't necessarily know, like we don't know anything. We think we know, like we're confident in our answers at the time, but all this shit could change. Like anything could change, you know, like a broken ankle for some people, it's, oh wow, well, I don't want to deal with this, and you know, here's a crutch, and then he's like leave the house. And then for some people it's like, okay, this is where I learned to be a crutch, and this is where I'm thankful to be the crutch, right, for you. And so I think that that's one of the things that kind of becomes evident when you get tested and whatever.
Can I share this? There's a thing I heard once about distance in a relationship makes, is like the wind. Distance is like the wind in that it will extinguish a small flame, but it will fan a great fire. Mm. So like, you know, the way that a forest fire, the wind makes it expand. And so if your love, if your connection is, you know, strong or whatever, you know, this is like a caricature of an analogy, but you know, like people say long distance relationships never work. Some long distance relationships do work. I mean, sometimes if it's exactly the way people want them to be, or if it's for only a limited time, or if they do what they want to and need to remain connected in those times. And so I think that similarly, the proximity that that a lot of us are experiencing right now is like, has the same function. Like for us, I've talked about this with my girlfriend. Like it's not that we don't have times when one of us, like there are times when we're in separate rooms.
Right.
Like I talk, like the other day, my girlfriend had a headache and I did a show from the other room, and even like through a door and through like, ear, you know, headphones that cancel the noise. Mm. She was like, "You have a booming voice that's great for your job."
Yeah.
You know? And so I joke, like, I'm like, "Oh yeah." So like part of it, what brought us together is she liked my comedy and we met at a show and talked. And so she was drawn to me because of my voice, and now she is repelled from me as well. She's like towards, and there's like, must be a perfect distance. So like that night I had a later show that I was like, I'm just going to do this one from very close to the microphone because my girlfriend's in the other room. So it's like an ASMR comedy show. And so, but for the most part, and we love each other. We're happy to be here, and we're, you know, grateful that we're not in a studio apartment. We don't have like the biggest house where we have a one bedroom where I'm in the living room now. She's in the bedroom, maybe with headphones and reading so that she can have her experience when she needs, because she needs often more time and space and quiet. But overall, we're in communication, if not constantly, like, you know, checking in to make sure that our needs are being addressed, if not met all of the time. If I'm like, I need to talk, and she's like, I need to not talk, then we're like, okay, well, that's good. We both know, we both understand, and whoever's need is maybe stronger in the moment. Right. We always want to assume that we have the best intentions. We want each other both to have what each what I want her to have what she wants. She wants me to have what I want. We want to help provide that for each other. So for us, the proximity is enhancing the flame of our relationship. Right. And, you know, I don't know what happens tomorrow or in a month or in 10 right. years or in 100 years.
But like, I'm nobody optimistic. Knows. You know what I mean? Yeah, nobody knows. You know, that's the thing. Like, I think there's certain things that get reinforced and then it makes people feel like they know. But, like, if they knew, then, like, motherfuckers would never break up. Nobody knows. We're all just kind of hoping for the best if you're, you know, if you're in a hopeful place. And yeah, we do the kind of similar thing. Like, we both, we have two bedrooms, but one is an office. Karen's a gamer and I'm a gamer and stuff. So, like, sometimes we'll just be gaming for hours in the other room or something. And then, like, occasionally, like, I might come in and just be like, everything okay? You all right? You good? Like, you need anything? Like, all right, cool. Everything's fine in here. All right, cool. Just want to check in. And, you know, and then it's like, you know, one day we were in here working and she was talking about how, like, I'm feeling a little bit down today. And it was like, let's get out of here. Like, we don't have to, like, go out and hug people and let them cough on us. We can still do things outside that just aren't, you know, they are not our normal things. We're not, like, going to eat out at a restaurant, but we can, like, go and walk around, or we can, like, I don't know, let's go wash the car or something like that. And so, like, you know, I think what's happening is that people are realizing that they have to, this is extra layer of stuff you have to do now that wasn't necessarily there before. You know what I mean? Like, before it's kind of like, well, I'm at my office, or I can stop by a place on my way home or something, and those options are not on the table anymore. And then, of course, also, it could just be that people were, like, on the rocks. And this right. is like a period of time where you can't break up for a lot of people, right? Like, it's this period of time where it's like, I need to lower my disease vectors. So I know your diseases and viruses. So you just stay here until this is over. But the second this is over, I'm going to get out there and meet some new disease vectors. Okay. Like, maybe that's what's happening.
Yeah. And I just want to offer for people, it's a challenging time for so many and self included. And it's a spectrum of how challenged you are in all right. of the ways that you are. I'm very fortunate in many ways. But I want to offer, like, if you have a relationship with someone that, let's say you weren't living together, but you moved in for the quarantine, or you were living together, you just started, or you've been living together, but you used to go to work and be apart from each other for 8 hours a day. And now, like, if it's harder now than it was before, like, that's very logical. That right. makes sense. That's okay. Like, the way that, and hopefully you can, you know, give yourself permission to, like, forgive yourself and forgive each other. Like, if you're losing your temper, if you're, like, unhappy in ways, you know, that essentially, like, when, you know, like, when I'm physically ill, if, like, if I have, you know, a fever, a cold, the flu, like, that, you know, makes me physically incapable of doing all the things that I would normally do, you know. So I forgive myself if I'm not going out to do comedy every night. I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to be, but I can't. Like, right. I can't go out for a walk, for exercise. Like, it always feels okay in that moment. And I feel like right now, our society, our culture, everything is kind of, like, impacted. Even if you're not physically ill, like, society has been slowed down yes. because of the overall metaphorical illness caused by right. the literal physical illness. And so I feel like hopefully that can, if that can help people offer themselves kindness in these times, to know that, like, you don't have, you know, maybe if it reveals things that were there, if it reveals cracks in your foundation that you just weren't looking at because you, and now you can't avoid looking at them, that's one thing. But right. for people, if you want to be optimistic that when you're no longer quarantined together, you can, if not go back to how things were, go forward to a potentially, you know, more stable and better and loving and caring place. And, I think that,
and also, like, it's not necessarily a failure, right? Because no. I think what happens is so many people look at, you know, because, like, I've seen the studies from China being like, all these people got divorced. Oh my God. And it's like, all those people now have the potential to move on to a situation where they're happier too. Like, right. why come out of this miserable? If you've been miserable for 3 months together and it's not working out or whatever. And, you know, like, it doesn't have to be and look at you failures. You all blew it. Like, you couldn't last one quarantine. Wow. I tell you, man. Like, love isn't what it used to be. Like, well, now maybe there's opportunities to go find happiness. I don't think anyone should be sitting there. We're not on this earth for long. Don't be miserable if you can help it. You know what I mean? Like, make those changes if you got to.
Can I tell you, there's a comedian in Boston named Tony V. He's been doing it since the 80s. He's one of the funniest people I've ever seen. And when I was starting doing comedy in the early 2000s, he did a one-person show, a one-man show. He's a man. And it was called The Failure Artist. Mm. And he, at the beginning of the show, he just showed a video montage of all of the show business, like, success that he had on TV and movies. He was in a few, like, he was in the Bobcat Goldthwait movie, Shakes the Clown. Mm. He was in the movie State and Maine. He played, like, a delivery guy. Like, he's since been in, like, the movie The Heat that I think filmed in Boston. He played, like, a cop with one line. He's like, I had, like, one line in a lot of movies. He's, like, in a John Cusack movie.
Right.
And he's, like, and I had, like, a Conan set. He did Conan. Like, he eventually would go on to be on, like, a show on Showtime. Like, his career has been fantastic. Like, he's, like, not, you know, a nationwide household name, but he is a Boston comedy, a New England comedy, like, household name. Like, he is revered and respected. At this time, still, he was. But he was presenting it. And he was saying, like, look, this 7 minutes of airtime is what I have, you know, accomplished. And he says, I went out to Hollywood and I took a lot of meetings. And the consensus is I am very nice to meet. And he's hilarious. And he says, like, so technically by this measure, I am a quote unquote failure. But he's like, I'm glad to be a failure because being a failure means I tried. And being a loser, if I was worried about quote unquote failing in the way that you're, it's like the same message with different language.
Yeah.
He's like, if I was worried about failing and if that worry made me not try, and so I wouldn't have the failure under my belt. Look, no failures over here because I didn't even try anything. Like, then not better. He's like, it's better to have tried and failed because I then, like, know where I succeeded. There's another comedian, Emily Winter, who last year or the year before, I had her on my podcast and she talked about her project, a rejection project. She made a New Year's resolution in one of these years, to one of the last 2 years, to get 100 rejections from anywhere, from stand-up bookers, from TV shows, from writing jobs, from The New Yorker, from The New York Times, from everywhere possible as a comedian, as a writer, because she's like, I think I've heard that to get 100 rejections, I'm going to have to put myself out there at least 100 times, and some of them might come back positive. I forget what the end result numbers were, but she had, like, however many acceptances, like 40, 50, 60, and 100-something. Like, so her rate, if it was, like, a batting average, was like, oh, it was actually pretty good for a batting average.
Right.
Maybe it was, like, batting 333. Like, if you look at, oh, my God, that sheer number of quote-unquote failures, but the failures don't add up is a thing I heard once a long time ago. Like, when you give somebody your resume, you don't say, here's everything I've achieved and here's everything that I didn't. Everything that you try adds to your successes. Even if it adds to your capacity to do things and to learn. Even Thomas Edison says, like, 1,000, 10,000 failures before the light bulb. No, he says that's 10,000 ways or 1,000 ways that I discovered successfully not to do it that led me to the one successful way that did do it.
Yep.
And Dan Savage talks about this all the time too with relationships, that a relationship isn't a failure just because it ends. It maybe is exactly like a show isn't a failure if it ends after the number of seasons that it told its whole story.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly how I look at it too. It's like, cause that was one of the issues I was having, was I wouldn't even attempt certain things. Cause I was like, I'm risking failing at the thing, so why even start? Let me just stick to the things I know I'm good at, right?
Because that's part of your personality. And I can be like that sometimes, but to an extent on a lot of things, I'm almost the opposite. I'm like, let's do it!
Yeah.
And they'd be like, you might fail. I don't care, let's try!
It took me, you know, I was like in therapy and stuff, and that was one of the things I learned from it, was like, oh yeah, I guess because I would never look at myself as a perfectionist. That's how she was like, you have some perfectionist qualities. And I'm like, no, not me. Like, I don't, like, look at my closet. I don't care. But she's like, right? She's like, no, it's not in that. It's in different things, you know, to a certain extent. Even the thing where I felt like, oh, I messed up with Mike. I can't have him back on the show. I fucked up. This is over. That is a type of weird perfectionism in a way of like, I blemished this thing. Sure. It is over, right? I quit. So yeah, it was, I think perfect can sometimes be the enemy of good and the enemy. So
oh, yeah.
And I think that's one of the things too, with relationships, it's hard for people to do, because even the transition, like quote unquote, out of polyamory into monogamy is like, like there's a way to view that as like, I failed polyamory, oh my god, how am I gonna go in front of all these people? And then there's like, you know, the healthier way, in my opinion, to look at it is be like, no, this is just like transitioning in or anything else. Like, this, whatever relationship is like a snowflake, is different, and so this one's this is what this one is, you know. So I think that was cool. The last thing I was gonna bring up too, because we haven't been talking a while, I told you guys, 5 questions, oh, yeah, 2 hours.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah,
about
relationships, of course.
Real quick. This one I think will be short. There's a woman named Esther Perel, who is a counselor of some kind, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, a therapist, who does specializes, I think, in couples counseling. Mm. And she also, I think, has a podcast where they do actual like couples counseling on the podcast.
Wow.
And I've heard her on Dan Savage's podcast a lot, and she's written a couple books called Mating in Captivity and State of Affairs. And one of the things that I heard recently that I liked a lot is that she says most people, or the average person maybe, has three great romances, three great like romantic loves in their life. And for some people, that doesn't mean that it's three different people. For some people, it could be a 50-year marriage has three different phases where both of the people have gone through changes. Like, you at 16 right. are different than you are at 40. So yeah. This is now either the second romance, or maybe this is the second one. So you did one for 20 years. Now you're on your second one. Then you'll do a third one if you keep going, because every however many years, you've hopefully grown and learned and changed in ways that make you a different person, make them a different person. And if you want to keep being together, it's important to communicate and express who you are and learn who they are. And ideally, or hopefully, or, you know, when it works well, when you do that, then best case scenario, you get to be like, oh, wow, I'm a different person with a different person, but also it's the same person. From the outside, all anyone sees is like, oh, you've been together 24 years with one person. And you're like, oh no, it's not, it's not one experience. It's three.
Like, I'm very, like, that's the thing. Like, I feel like the way I love Karen at 16 is different because, like, as you get older, you also know the cost of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I think it's not necessarily easier, but it's just different when you don't know shit. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, and most people, I think, feel like that's the highest version of love, right? It's just like the newlywed phase. We want to like constantly, consistently be in the like, everything about you is great because I don't know shit about you. Oh my God. You know, like, and there's a point too where like the knowledge of somebody is a different type of love that is also good. Like, when you're like young, it's like, you know, kisses don't cost anything, right? They're abundant and they're always coming and there's always going to be more. But then you cross like a threshold in life where you're like, this kiss could be the last kiss. Like you start thinking shit like that. Now, that was true when you were 16, by the way. But,
right,
but
you didn't think
but
of it
now,
like that.
But now you know, like, you're like, this shit is fleeting. Like, anything could happen. And vice versa. Like, I think that's why sometimes people do get divorces. You know, like, sometimes you read stuff where it's like, this 70-year-old got divorced from this 75-year-old. And people are always like, that's so sad. They were together forever. I was like, no, that motherfucker knows. The last 15 years, I gotta figure this out. Like this might be it right here, baby. I gotta come up with something. But yet the last thing I was gonna say was that talking about this, the COVID-19, the coronavirus and stuff, have you guys seen the people that are like doing the marches that are like, we don't want a social distance and, let's get our guns and go hang out?
I mean, I've seen it in the news. I'm glad to have not seen it close up. It seems like I want everyone to be healthy and fulfilled. And in these cases, I'm like, where somebody's like, not us, you know,
yeah.
like the person you brought up, like I when I reminded me earlier of a guy, I think like a homophobic preacher was like, the coronavirus is caused by people being gay, and then he got the coronavirus. I'm like, I don't want anyone to get it,
right?
But if someone has to get it, that's funny.
And
I do want to say also to what you just said about like people wanting to stay in the like the newly, like I was a person who wanted to, who liked new relationship energy. Like it's, of course it makes sense. It's, it feels good, but I'm glad to now know the different ways that being in a long-term relationship feels good in new ways.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I'm like, oh, even if I like newness, I'm like, this has newnesses in it. And it's sort of like a baby's brain, you know, it could learn every language, you know, if it spoke it around it, the connections are almost like limitless compared to eventually you learn one language, you learn things and the neural pathways close off and you get the language that you know. And then it's harder to learn one later. And that's like your relationship at the beginning. It seems like infinite possibilities. Like it's so new. We don't know anything. We have so much to learn, so much to do, so much to grow, so much. But, 'cause you're a baby. Your relationship is literally, your relationship is figuratively a baby. It's a baby. And it's great. Like babies are wonderful. They're for for the reasons that, like the same way with love that your friend Rashida said, like, loving the way that you can love at a time, the way that you're capable of, the way that that love makes sense. Like a baby is great for all the things that a baby is, but a baby's not like a great partner to marriage. You want that baby to grow up first.
Like the baby can't drive the car. Baby has to have a baby seat. Okay. Can't drive the car, you know, like, and it's interesting too, because like, I also think the quarantine for people that are like being alone right now, are also getting to like love themselves or learn how to, or see what they can, like what's going on with them that maybe, maybe you haven't been able to check in with yourself because you have been leaving the house for 10 hours to do a job and coming back and commuting and doing like all this other stuff that kind of like keeps you from connecting with whatever you're into. Right. So like, I would hope that, I mean, not, you know, I guess I'm just trying to look on the positive side of all this stuff is like, I hope people are able to like kind of examine and find what does make them happy. If you know, if they are able to, do that thing where they have their enough needs met to be able to think of that way, to think that way. 'Cause I don't know, man. It's like, if not, we're just trapped in the house and it's all sad. So, you know, I hope people are finding some goodness in it. 'Cause I do think that is, like, at least with love, that's how I've learned about it, was just like, oh, wait. I am informed now more. And so I still do have that, like, you know, the feelings of like giddiness and all that type of stuff that comes sometimes, but it's something deeper than that. You know what I mean? It's like a video game. When you first pick up a brand new video game and there's all this shit you can do and you're just like, all the missions, oh my god, I'm overwhelmed, there's so much shit you can, oh, there's a mission over here, like with ADHD,
a new request,
yeah, we have like ADHD with a video game, you're just like, what does this do, and you're just like doing the shit. But then there's also like that love of like when you know the ins and out of a video game, like you just love it differently, like I've beaten Miss Pac-Man 75 times, like I love that game differently than I love the new game. It's no offense to the new game. It doesn't mean I'll never play a new game again, but there's just like a love I have for this game that I, you know, for Tomb Raider, Lara Croft, that I just have differently. But here's what I was gonna say. The people protesting against the virus. So y'all know how the virus works, right? Like a virus, it attaches itself to like some of your healthy cells. And then it makes them kind of like sick. It makes them replicate the virus. And then like the not healthy, like the antibody cells will come in and like attack this virus. And they start, and the antibody cells, they don't give a fuck. They're just like, we don't know what this is. Attack everything, even the healthy lung cells, all that stuff. Wait, did I lose Karen? Karen, are you still on screen?
Can you hear me?
Oh, I see you. Okay, you came back. Yeah. All right. So then like it attacks everything, right? Like your antibody, that's one of the problems with the COVID thing, is like people get pneumonia and then your antibodies, like I think it's called cytokine storm or something. Cytokine storm. Well, it attacks. Yeah. It attacks like your healthy stuff. And then that's what makes your lungs shut down and stuff. In a weird way, it feels like that's what our society is doing. We're like, these people, like, we're doing, like, we have healthy cells and we have cells that are designed to fight the virus that are like, guys, we have emergency room workers. We're going to stand 6 feet apart. we're gonna wear masks. We have governors and all these like smart people that are just like, this is their thing. This is epidemiologists, like, hey, this is how we mitigate this thing. And then you just wait and then it'll pass because we're fighting it. Like, and then the fucking like people with the guns and the MAGA hats and the camouflage and the shades are all coming out and they're being like, fuck everything. Fuck those people trying to save us. Fuck the hospital people. Fuck the mask. Fuck social distancing. I am here to say it's all bad. Open it back up. Like, let's all go back to just fucking like doing what we were doing before. And that's what it's like the America's response to the virus has been the body's response to the virus on some extent. I don't know, when Mike was talking, it just made me think about that all at the same time. I was like, fuck, it's like we're living the human version of fighting the virus as well as the individual people fighting the virus.
Oh yeah, those people are literally antibodies, like their own
yes.
bodies.
Yeah.
They're hurting themselves. And yeah. This reminds me, my girlfriend told me this thing once about her childhood mm-hmm. when she was like maybe even pre-verbal, but she's very, very young. But she remembers one of her earliest memories reaching towards like the hot bulb of a lamp and that her mother was there and she said, don't touch that. Like, you'll get burned. Don't touch that. It'll hurt you. And she remembers, my girlfriend remembers not listening. I mean, she like heard the sounds of her saying that was like, and then touched it and was like, ah. And then like in that split second, like when you say what, and then you're like, oh, I actually heard you. Then she was like, oh, that lady was trying to, that's what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. She was trying to help me. Maybe I should listen to that lady. And I feel like that's what the government is like, at least, you know, a lot of helpful right. scientists yeah. and people who are spreading valuable, as accurate as possible information as we have of how to best protect yourself, to protect like from this lamp, from this disease. Like, we don't have all the answers. Nobody has all the answers, but right. the best people, like that adult, my girlfriend's mother knew more than my baby girlfriend did.
Right.
And scientists know more than I do and know more than non-scientists. If you're a person who studies this disease or studies diseases, you know more. So it certainly behooves us to listen to the people who are sharing this information and doing what we can. And then even further than my girlfriend, it was like my girlfriend, I used to tell the story in a way that she was like, it's not actually that, but I was like, where she was like, rebelling, you know, where she was like you can't tell me what to do. I'm gonna touch this if I want to. Ow, oh, you were trying to help me.
Yeah.
But that's what it seems like. Some people are like, you can't tell me how to help myself. You can't tell me how
right.
to protect myself. Like, I hurt myself if I want to, in a way, and yeah. other people. And
kind of scary because like just kind of seeing the rise of like anti-science for like most of my life and how strong and organized it's gotten to be. Like, this is kind of where that comes into play, right? It's like, this is the day of the science test, and half of the people have not only just not been going to class, but they've been like, class is bad. Learning about the science test is the problem. If we didn't know about the science test, we'd all be in class having fun or whatever. And that's kind of like the culmination of this. It's like half of us are like, you know, all right, guys, we got to do what the doctor says, stay inside. And then half of us are like, fuck the doctors. We can, I'll figure this out myself. I read, it's 5G on cell phones or something. Listen, guys, check out Mike Kaplan, new album dropping May 8th, aka,
yes.
All Killing Aside, or also, All Kidding Aside, or also known as, or, you know, Alpha Kappa Alpha, whatever the, for the sororities out there. But yeah, make sure you guys check it out, man. Mike, you're always a pleasure to talk to, man.
Always.
I appreciate you coming back on the show, man.
Same. It's such a delight. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks everyone for listening and ordering and or pre-ordering the album or living your life, buying food, whatever you need to use your money for. Thank you.
It won't take as long for me to have you back on the show. I promise you that much. Okay.
I now will also make a more concerted effort. It's, we will be friends who communicate even more than we ever did before. Another bonus to come out of these times.
Shout out to coronavirus, yes. bringing us all together. Even though we're 6 feet apart. All right, guys. we'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Until then, I love you.
I love you too.
Mwah.